brought us to the brink of nuclear war, obstructed justice at the FBI, and in direct violation of the Constitution, he's taken money from foreign governments and threatened to shut down news organizations that report the truth. If that isn't a case for impeaching and removing a dangerous president, then what has our government become?
California billionaire Tom Steyer, his ads pushing impeachment, caught the attention of President Trump this morning. He shot off a tweet calling Steyer wacky and unhinged. We'll get Tom Steyer's response in a few minutes. First, the fires in Northern California earlier this month left at least 42 people dead. More than 8,000 structures burned to the ground. 5,000 of those were homes that were completely destroyed. The fires are not fully contained yet, but they're close, close enough that attention has shifted to rebuilding and recovery. Earlier, I spoke with Anna Gibert. She moved to Napa last year to be closer to her family. She got a job at a local winery in the valley. As the fires approached, Anna evacuated with her parents. They weren't sure what had happened to her father's home. And after a few days, they went to find out.
He said, "I'm going." And so that's when I grabbed my camera. And I just thought to myself, he might be upset with me now, but it's a moment that's not going to come back.
Dad.
What?
Just please don't touch anything.
Because I hadn't seen it. And that's the video you see where I'm kind of chasing after him because there was ember still burning.
Dad, please don't touch anything.
Well, this is the safe.
Dad, don't touch
the
anything.
Devastation was complete.
These are probably toxic fumes that we're sitting in, okay, Dad? Put your mask on. Put your mask on, Dad. Put your mask on.
It's a sad... It was a sad moment. He didn't have to say very much because he was just... His shoulders were hunched over, and he was kind of saying, "Oh, my God." And he was devastated. I mean, everything in his whole entire history and had been put into that home, and he couldn't believe it. He was just in absolute shock. My father's a man who came to this country with nothing, and so creating something that was he was proud of to share with his family and his children and his wife, and that was his life dream. He was desperate to find something that hadn't burned, and as he's standing there looking over the fires, there was nothing. I mean, every single inch of this property was burnt to the ground.
That was Anna Gibert in Napa. Her dad and his wife now live with her in her apartment. James Gore has heard many stories like this in the past few weeks. He's a Sonoma County supervisor. And when I spoke with him, he told me what it's like to drive around the area right now.
You still smell the smoke. In the community, you can see people hugging and crying and going through different stages of grief. The people directly impacted who have lost their homes are battling through the world of trying not to become victims. And that's what I'm trying to help them through. And then the rest of the folks who experience the fear and the potential for disaster, but who still have their own homes and their own beds to sleep in, they're still impacted, but they're getting back to life.
When you say trying not to become victims, what do you mean by that?
I was at a meeting last night with about 250 people who had lost their homes, and it just hit me like a ton of bricks that their houses are not just what was there, are not just rebuild sites and cleanup sites, but as my colleague and one of my mentors who went through this in the Valley Fire in Lake County told me, is that they are sacred sites. These are places where people took their kids home for the first time out of the hospital, where they ate dinner every night, where they filled their places and their hearts with love. And there has to be some honor to that outside of the systematic approach to cleaning up debris removal and price per square foot and insurance recollections and things like that. So that's the thing that I want to honor.
How do you do that?
You start by listening and by showing up and not just sitting on a panel and talking platitudinal and high level. You do everything from like this last week as the Board of Supervisors, we passed a series of emergency ordinances That would have been political suicide a month ago because of the need right now for what we need to do. But then you juxtapose that against the fact that I was dealing with Bob and Shirley, who have lived in their house for 54 years and are dear friends. And he's just screaming because he wants to be able to put a storage shed to save what he's saved. That's 128 square feet instead of 120. And I have to help him get through that permit process and make sure we don't get in his way, because damn it if I'm going to keep him away from the 8 square feet he needs.
So when you're talking about these ordinances, that's what you're talking about? That would have been political suicide a month ago?
Well, things like not allowing any more vacation rental permits for the short term. So a lot of the housing things, having RVs and trailers be able to go onto lots even without sewer connections as long as they have a tank. So changing all these laws that have been put into place to protect the community in a time of peace, but now with a time of disaster, is still making sure you hold on to the intention of those laws, but you don't let the bureaucracy hold you back.
Mm. What about getting federal help? How is that going? Are you getting the money and the help you need from the federal government?
We are. FEMA, and through the Emergency Disaster Declaration, through the administration, went the step beyond normal cleanup and into what's called individual assistance that provides a stipend for people that assists in a lot of different ways. On the other side, from FEMA, through the California Office of Emergency Services, they're coming in with the bulk money that is for the cleanup right now. And then whatever goes beyond what people's individual insurance provides, which is the first amount, they are going to cover basically everything to get it back to a place where your lot is clean and you're able to build with whatever your insurance provides.
There are some reports that some undocumented immigrants who work in the area, maybe at the wineries, are not applying for federal aid because they're afraid that they might be deported.
Yeah, not surprising. And we started moving heavily on the issue of immigrant rights and protecting our community, documented and undocumented, earlier this year as a result of the executive orders. So we've created something called UndocuFund, which has already pulled in $100,000+, which is going directly to undocumented individuals through local groups. And we're seeing really good traction. So the thing that brings me pain is when I hear that folks, especially immediately after the fire, were going out and not going to the shelters, right? They were in tents out by the ocean. I speak fluent Spanish, and I actually went and started talking to people individually and listening to their fears and worries and connecting them personally with resources.
And did they come into the shelters after that? Or
yes, more
afraid?
And more. No, they came in. If you want to communicate with people, you don't do what you think you should do. You go to where they already communicate through.
So it sounds like you've learned that the bureaucracy can work, but it's limited, that you need to sort of take matters into your own hands when necessary. And
absolutely. And government that, can't do it all.
Yeah.
And it's not built to be nimble. It's right. Built to be risk averse.
And so when you look forward to how your community will look maybe a year from now, do you see it looking a lot different than it did a month ago?
In every way possible. The vast majority of the houses that burnt were not million-dollar houses in the hills, but rather workforce housing, teachers, electricians, plumbers, you know, everyday folks who met their mortgage and worked their tails off. And my goal, number one, on the housing front is that they have a place and that we do whatever we need to do to make sure they can stay, come back, be whole, and not be victims. On the other side, we have these huge issues like the fact that if we don't protect our mountains that have burnt, we could, and we get the kind of rains we did last year, historic rains, we could have a double disaster. A crisis could turn into a nightmare. And so we need to upstream that. So you kind of got to do it all at once.
James Gore, Sonoma County Supervisor, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, why liberal billionaire Tom Steyer thinks he can get the president impeached. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Wacky and totally unhinged is how President Trump described California billionaire Tom Steyer on Twitter this morning. It's likely Trump caught one of Steyer's ads. It ran during Fox and Friends.
A Republican Congress once impeached a president for far less. Yet today, people in Congress and his own administration know that this president is a clear and present danger, who's mentally unstable and armed with nuclear weapons. And they do nothing. Join us and tell your member of Congress that they have a moral responsibility to stop doing what's political and start doing what's right.
Tom Steyer says he spent $10 million on the ad campaign. He can afford it. He is one of the biggest donors to Democratic candidates in the country, and he's rumored to be considering a Senate run against Dianne Feinstein. He's the founder of the grassroots political group Next Gen America. And when he came by KCRW this morning, I asked what he thought when he saw the president's tweet today.
I thought that he was scared about getting criticized and was scared that the American people are rejecting him because he has been behaving badly. This is really him reacting not to me, but this whole exercise has been about trying to activate the voice of the American people and get people to sign on and basically give a voice to all the Americans who agree that he is a danger to them and their family, that he has met the standard for impeachment, and that it's very bad for this country that he's the president and there's an urgency to getting him out of there.
And how many people have signed on?
It's been going for less than a week, and we have hundreds of thousands of people. I think at some point, I'm sure our office will put up some kind of explicit number, or we've thought about having a public, the equivalent of a billboard with a running total, mm-hmm. so people can see as people sign up, you know, that the numbers are growing so fast. I mean, what we've seen in the last week is four really prominent Republicans, one ex-president, and three sitting Republican senators denouncing the president as unfit.
When you look at, you mentioned Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, two retiring senators who came out very strongly this week criticizing President Trump as unfit for office. But you look at them and politically, it seems like, well, you can say that when you're not running for office again. And both of them were facing tough re-election prospects. And many analysts are saying that this Republican Party is now the party of Trump. Even though his popularity in nationwide opinion polls is pretty low, amongst his base and amongst the Republican Party, he's still very popular. And he could very well win re-election. What do you think about that?
I've heard people say that the Republican Party is going to the alt-right, into the Steve Bannon slash Donald Trump version of Republicanism. All I can say is I think that that is a road that leads to perdition and ruin. I think what they're doing is deeply wrong. I think it is deeply anti-American. I think that there's a subculture of racism that they're promoting.
How do you account for his popularity, though, amongst his base? And this is a base that isn't necessarily made up of millionaires and billionaires.
For Americans, we are the hardest working people in the world. And I think a lot of people feel like, wow, I'm really willing to work, but are my skills matched with this incredibly fast changing world? Can my family and I be part of the positive changes, or are we going to be left behind? So I think there was a profound unease and insecurity that wasn't being addressed. And he came up with a very toxic, evil, and divisive answer to real concerns. And I think that what he was really saying is all those things that you're worried about will just draw a wall around ourselves and we'll keep out all that scary world.
Now, what do you say to people who say this is a way for Tom Steyer to raise his profile, his political profile, his name recognition, and a way to perhaps test the waters for your own run for office, perhaps as challenging Dianne Feinstein for her Senate seat?
this is a moral question, not a political question, you know, not a some sort of tactical political action. This is a question of we need to do the right thing. Our country's at risk, and we should be reacting to it and taking action.
And when will you decide or make an announcement on the Senate bid?
Well, I don't think I have a specific deadline. I think that at this point, what we're really trying to do is work hard on this impeachment question to try and get people to sign on so that we know that there is a voice that is directly that you can take action and stand up to Trump. And that is really what I'm spending my time on. And I think, you know, from the standpoint of making a difference, that's at this point what I think I can do, where I can make the most difference.
Tom Steyer, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Some perspective now from Jack Pitney, professor of American politics at Claremont McKenna College and also a former Republican strategist. Hi, Jack.
How you doing?
Great. Well, what do you make of Tom Steyer's impeachment campaign? He says it isn't about him. It's about the president. He says it's a moral issue. What do you think?
From a practical standpoint, it has virtually no chance of succeeding, at least in the next year or so. As long as there is a Republican majority in the House of Representatives, there is not going to be a resolution of impeachment that passes. And until you get some kind of report from Robert Mueller, it's unlikely that this kind of move would get substantial support from the general public. So if he's hoping that this is going to lead to the impeachment of Trump in the near term, he's sadly mistaken.
Well, I think he thinks that if he gets enough Americans to sign on, that they will then pressure lawmakers to take this more seriously.
He says that lawmakers will take it more seriously if he gets signatures. However, the signatures he's getting will be from Democrats and progressives, but Congress is controlled by Republicans, and they're not likely to respond to pressure from that political corridor.
And he didn't rule out running for Senate himself, maybe challenging Dianne Feinstein. What do you think that would do to the race?
That would considerably change the dynamics of the race. Kevin DeLeon, I think, is underrated as a potential challenger. But if Steyer gets in with his ability to self-finance, that would be a tremendous blow to DeLeon's chances. And Steyer could self-finance the race. The two things are related. By having this movement toward impeachment, Steyer doesn't really bring Trump any closer to impeachment, but he does get his own face in front of the general public, which may, of course, be the real motive here. Trump has denounced him, and in progressive Democratic circles, that's one of the greatest honors one could get, a tweet from Donald Trump denouncing you. So that really may be what all of this is about.
He says it's not, that that's just cynical political analysis.
In 2017, cynical political analysis is another word for realism.
Okay. Well, would he pose much of a threat to Dianne Feinstein?
Well, anybody with that much money has to be taken seriously as a candidate. Feinstein has considerable advantages with name recognition, incumbency, strong support in the Democratic Party. But she has not had a competitive election since 1994, and her campaign muscles may have atrophied in the time being. I wouldn't rule him out, and if he were to devote his resources to that kind of campaign against an incumbent who really has not had to work very hard to get reelected in decades, he could have a real chance.
Let me ask you about the broader political climate on the right in the Republican Party. You're a former Republican strategist, and we saw, as we just mentioned, Jeff Flake, Bob Corker leaving with some pretty fiery words about the president. What do you think about this war inside the Republican Party, the Bannon side wing versus the McConnell wing? And do you think that the Bannon wing and, by extension, President Trump are winning and the Republican Party is now President Trump's party?
At the moment, Republican voters are very strongly supporting President Trump. Polls indicate that Mitch McConnell isn't particularly popular among rank-and-file Republican voters. That doesn't mean that Bannon-style candidates are going to win a lot of primaries. So those candidates themselves may have shortcomings that will keep them from rising too far. But when it comes to Trump versus Flake, if you were to take a poll among ordinary Republicans, Trump would win that contest. And that's likely to be the dynamic unless and until Robert Mueller produces something that really changes people's minds.
And where does the California GOP fit in?
California GOP is right now very strongly pro-Trump. The party is shrinking, and as it shrinks, that narrow core is increasingly conservative, increasingly pro-Trump. Of course, that tendency will make it very difficult for the party to win general elections anytime in the near future.
Jack Pitney, professor of American politics at Claremont McKenna, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll take a break from the politics and the news, and we will have our regular Friday movie segment. And later on, I'll speak with Swedish director Ruben Östlund, who made Force Majeure, and now The Square. It's about a sophisticated art museum curator whose liberal values are tested.
I put up dilemmas for him. I put up him in situations where it's hard to be a humanist, when it's hard to be morally correct.
Movies and The Square next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Friday, time for movie reviews and time for a little Halloween horror. April Wolf is here. She's lead film critic for the LA Weekly. Hi.
Hey there.
And Whitney Seibold is here, too. He contributes to Nerdist and co-hosts the podcast Canceled Too Soon. Hi, Whitney.
Hello.
All right, let's start with some horror. First up, part of the Saw series. This is called Jigsaw. Here's a clip.
Now the game's simple. Best ones are. You want mercy? Play by the rules.
Okay, Whitney, you saw this one. What are the rules that we need to play by?
The rules are familiarize yourself with the previous seven films in the series before you go in, because the Saw series is one of the most convoluted series of films ever.
I have to say I've never seen a one.
They're easy to get lost in. They play with chronology a lot. Uh-huh. There's flashbacks within flashbacks all throughout this series. Jigsaw, the eighth film in the series and the first since Saw the Final Chapter, what a lie, in 2010, is maybe the least playful of the bunch. The premise is the same as all the other previous films. A killer named Jigsaw, presumably dead, has set up an automated series of blade and chain based traps. He traps people in them and has them confess their sins. And of course they don't, so we can watch them get mutilated horribly.
You'd think they'd know by now, after the first seven.
You'd think so. He's a well-known figure in this universe, and they know his games. But no, they still refuse, and they still get their heads lopped off in horrible fashions.
Is this fun?
If you like watching people getting their heads chopped off, yeah, it's plenty fun. It's just sort of light, fun horror entertainment. It's strangely a lot less filthy than the previous films in the series. Saw's stock and trade has always been kind of this grimy moral emptiness about how the world is just garbage and the only way to really shake people out of their complacency is to torture them. They did come up in a time when torture was very much on horror's mind. It feels a little bit out of place here in 2017.
Yeah.
Almost feels like nostalgia at this point. It's kind of odd that we're having a kind of quaint nostalgia for these grimy torture films that really relish on the gore.
I do not have a quaint nostalgia for them.
Some people do, though. There is a certain contingent of horror audience that goes to these movies just so they can see the entrails fly out of a person's body or watch a human head fall into eight pieces. And in that regard, Jigsaw does not disappoint.
Okay, next, a film about a blind woman played by Blake Lively. She regains her sight, and here's a clip from All I See Is You.
Does it ever bother you having to take care of me?
No. It makes me feel special.
I'll restore the optical properties of the right eye. You'll be able to count fingers on day one.
By week four, you should be at 20/50.
April, I take it that when she regains her sight, all is not clear.
Yeah, that's the best way to put it. It's a lot like Jigsaw. I'm sorry. No, it's nothing. It's nothing like Jigsaw.
Do they pull the eyeballs out?
Yeah, right. So Mark Forster directed this one, and I think most people know him specifically from Monsters Ball way back when. He's done a bunch of stuff since then. This is a really experimental film that I was not expecting when I came into it. And I ended up loving it because it's so weird. To me, it becomes part of that canon of this fall mainstream release, including, you know, Mother and Blade Runner 2049, where you don't know exactly what you're going to get, but mainstream audiences are going to see it. The experimental part comes in where he goes into the POV of Blake Lively, and he's kind of presents this weird collage and swirling colors and things, and you're in this weird space, and everything feels really tense.
Before she regains her sight.
Before she regains her sight, and even after, because there's still some residual things where she's not quite clear. Uh-huh. And so he presents this whole story of this disillusion of a marriage with the suspenseful urgency of a thriller. The style and the tone makes it feel really, really tense and strange.
Is it because once she sees her husband, she's not that jazzed?
Well, she's not that jazzed, and she's not that jazzed on most things. She's not that jazzed on the clothes that she's been wearing for years. You know, she's like, oh, my God, this is what I am. And when she learns to put on makeup, she just smears it all over her face, really. It's just like, I want to, you know, have colors. I want to be things. And Jason Clarke, this sad, sad actor who is quite handsome, is now getting typecast into this, like, kind of sad sack, not that handsome partner kind of guy. Like, you're going to see that later in Mudbound as well, Reese's Mudbound. But he's so, so good in this role of the disappointing lover. Hmm. And so you watch them try to figure out what life is like when she can actually see. And it's just not fun for her. And he becomes more and more clingy. He wants to hold her back, and she just wants to keep going forward. It's all set in Thailand and Spain and these beautiful locations. And yeah, very strange film. Was not expecting this at all.
But you recommend?
I do recommend, yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to a George Clooney-directed film called Suburbicon. It stars Matt Damon, Julianne Moore, and Oscar Isaac.
There's something I have to tell you. Those men killed your mom.
We've decided it'd be best if your Auntie Margaret came and stayed with us.
Mickey needs a mother.
We'll be strong. We'll be fine.
Mr. Lodge?
Yes.
You know a character named Rizzoli? He's a loan shark. If you were into the mob for money, that might explain what happened to your wife.
Ooh, Whitney. There seem to be some suspenseful hijinks afoot.
Suspenseful hijinks that don't amount to much, I'm afraid. George Clooney did direct this. It's from a screenplay by the Coen brothers that they wrote back in the 1980s, back when 1950s suburbia was really being deconstructed more actively. If you go back to the 1980s, you'll find a lot of films about 50s suburbia and 50s greasers just sort of invading the consciousness. And this takes place in a post-war town called Suburbicon. The catalyst for action, it would appear, is the moving in of a black family into this all-white neighborhood and how all of the local racists just get up in a dander. And this part of the film feels very timely. Unfortunately, that's sort of a subplot or a backdrop to the actual main action of the film, wherein Matt Damon plays the patriarch of a small white family. Julianne Moore plays his wife and his sister-in-law, and they have a young son who's about 10. And one evening, their home is invaded by these evil Coen brothers-looking mob guys.
Do kind they of have fedoras?
Kind of cartoonish and over the top. And indeed, George Clooney directs to the walls. Everything's really super production designed, and everything's a little bit too clean. And as the story goes on, we do learn of some dark shadings in Matt Damon's past and how he might, in fact, be the villain of the piece. Don't necessarily want to give anything else away. George Clooney has something on his mind, but I'm not exactly sure what it is. He's clearly trying to make some sort of very broad critique of 1950s suburbia, something that's very common. It's an easy target. But he's not really bringing anything new to the table, and I'm not exactly sure what he's trying to say with this story. And it doesn't really play as much of a thriller, and it doesn't feel as timely as it maybe ought to, despite the riots that take up such a frustratingly small amount of the film itself.
Well, why didn't the Coen brothers direct it themselves?
Well, clearly they didn't want to. They don't direct all of their screenplays. They did a film called Crime Wave back in the 80s, which was directed by Sam Raimi. Maybe they just didn't have faith in this material. Maybe they figured George Clooney would have a better hand at it. He has directed a few good films in the past. But this is him sort of in sub-Leatherheads territory, where he's more interested in wallowing in nostalgia and production design than he is in saying anything of substance.
All right, so that's a miss.
It's a mess.
Suburbicon. Yeah. Let's move on to Novitiate. That's about a young woman who joins a nunnery in the 1960s.
Since, unfortunately, God can't be here to run this convent himself, my voice will serve as a stand-in for his. You'll be spending the next 6 months as postulants. After that, you'll enter the novitiate. Any questions? Put your hand down, sister. Postulants don't have questions. And you are free to go home.
Okay, that's Melissa Leo, though. Leo there, April. And so how is she in this role, and what did you think of the movie?
Well, I think she fits quite well. She does this kind of stern but kind of scary motherly voice, you know, behind mm-hmm. the habit. The film overall, I felt, was uneven. I think like the first third of the film, I felt like I didn't even need to see it. This is directed by Maggie Betts, and this is her first feature that's not a documentary. And you can kind of see these newbie things that happen in the early part of the film where a new filmmaker feels that they need to explain everything right away. So you've got this, it's 1964, and the woman who's entering the convent, her name is Kathleen, and we see her as a child. And I'm not sure exactly why we need to see her as a child to see why she wants to join this nunnery. And then once we get into the nunnery, however, it becomes a lot more nuanced. And it's a little bit tense, and you start seeing these really interesting things that these nuns wanted to do to show their devotion to God. And I think it shows these nuns in a very human way. You know, even if these mother superiors were trying to maybe torture these young souls, they were doing it out of love. And it was a tradition that had been going on for centuries. You know, this wasn't something new. So it's a history lesson in a way.
Okay, let's say we want to stay home and watch an old favorite for Halloween in honor to get into the mood. Any recommendations?
Oh, I'm really excited because I like going through the John Carpenter Apocalypse trilogy.
Oh, yes.
Because most people only watch The Thing because that's the first one and it's, you know, phenomenal. But if you are done with The Thing and you've seen it recently, move on to Prince of Darkness, which is the second one. And then In the Mouth of Madness is the third. So if you're feeling like the world is ending like I am, this might be a good trilogy to, you know,
do you just recommend watching into. One after the other after the other?
They're only thematically
binging.
Linked.
Just so thematically linked. I think it's, and you know, Prince of Darkness in some ways is kind of fun. You know, it's that 1980s, like Donald Pleasance, you know, discovers like a green goo slime in the basement of a church. And it's like, it's the, you know, Satan rising, really, the Prince of Darkness. It's ridiculous.
Or just bad plumbing.
It's wonderful.
Well, if we're going to go with fun, goopy 80s horror movies, I have to recommend perhaps the entire filmography of Frank Henenlotter. Frank Henenlotter directed such scintillating films as Basket Case and Frankenhooker. He has such a strange sensibility. He's trying to make essentially live-action Looney Tunes, but with gore instead of dynamite. Basket Case, which is his first film, is about a man who's looking to... He travels to the big city with his twin brother. His twin brother, however, is a misshapen lump that he keeps inside of a basket. And occasionally this thing called Belial sneaks out of the basket and starts committing murders. And he has to sort of reconcile for what this monstrous twin brother of his is doing. There are two sequels, and they're all pretty spectacular.
I believe that X-Files episode at the Freak Show is also based on someone's love for Basket Case,
most
too.
Most certainly inspired by Frank Henenlotter.
Yeah.
Wow, you guys are blowing my mind. All right. So that sounds a lot more fun than seeing Saw 5000.
There are a few things that are more fun than watching Frank Henenlotter movies.
Okay. Whitney Seibold contributes to Nerdist and co-hosts the podcast Cancel Too Soon. April Wolf, lead film critic for LA Weekly. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the director of the new movie, The Square, a Swedish film that skewers liberal pretension. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The highest prize at the Cannes Film Festival is the Palme d'Or, or the Golden Palm. This year, Swedish director Ruben Östlund won it for his latest film. It's called The Square. Östlund is a master of the awkward, embarrassing moment. You know, that moment when we're confronted with our own bad behavior.
Okay, you were inside of me. That's what happened.
Yes, I am. I'm aware of that.
Okay, good. Hmm? You remember that then?
Yes. Listen, that is part of it.
Yes, it's a big part of it.
Yeah.
It's also part of it.
When a man and a woman, you know, the man is...
Good.
In that woman, yeah?
And that meant something, did it not?
Absolutely.
Okay, what did it mean to you?
That's Elizabeth Moss and Klaas Bang. Bang plays Christian, the square's main character. He's a tall, polished director of a modern art museum, very comfortable in that rarefied elitist world. It's the real world and the dilemmas it can pose that he has more trouble with. The square opens tonight, and I'm joined now by director Ruben Östlund. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's talk about The Square. The title of your movie is actually a piece of artwork in the movie called The Square, and it is literally a square in a courtyard, and it has an inscription, "The square is a sanctuary of trust and caring. Within it, we all share equal rights and obligations." What is this thing?
This is actually an art piece, or I would prefer calling it a humanistic traffic sign, actually, that exists in two cities in Sweden and two cities in Norway.
So it is a real thing.
Yeah, and I created it together with a friend of mine. And the idea for this project started when I was doing a feature film called Play, where very young boys were robbing other young boys in the center of the city where I live, in Göteborg, in Sweden. And these were true events. They happened in the center of the city. And I read through the court files. And when I read the court files, you could tell it was very seldom that any adult interacted in the robberies. So even though it was adult just close to the robberies, there was very few occasions where an adult helped the kids. Kids didn't ask for help either. So it was like the adult world and the kids' world were taking place on two parallel levels. And I talked to my father about this. And he said that when he was brought up in Stockholm during the 50s, his parents put an address tag around his neck and wrote the address to the apartment where they live and sent him out on the streets of Stockholm to play all alone.
And what?
Yeah,
that sounds crazy these days.
It sounds crazy these days, exactly. And I mean, he was expressing it like the attitude have changed in society. Back in the 50s, you were looking at other adults as someone that would help your children if they ended up in trouble. Mm-hmm. And other adults has had a responsibility of bringing up all children in society. And today it's almost like that we look at other adult as a possible threat.
Adult as a threatening force.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And this is even though society have not become more dangerous, actually. So there's like a paranoia, mm-hmm. and there is an attitude change on how we look on our role as fellow human beings. And in this context, me and my friend created this white marked square where we wanted to create a new social contract.
And to be clear, the square is just painted lines on the street.
Yeah, that's sure. It. It's like a LED light to it also, so it shines mm-hmm. in the night and things like that. But it's very, very simple. It's like making a border. And within this border, we have a social contract, a different social contract. And maybe actually... what the best would be if, of course, we didn't need a square at all, that we have this social contract everywhere in society where we are trying to live up to these humanistic topics and values. But in order to remind ourselves of these, we built this humanistic traffic sign.
So this is the idea behind your movie. It's called The Square, and you are examining this question that you've just talked about, the social contract, right? Mm. And what happens when the social contract frays, when we no longer feel responsible for each other?
Mm. Exactly. I would say like that. I mean, to maintain an equal society, it's an ongoing struggle. It's something that we always have to remind ourselves of because inequality happens in every social situation mm-hmm. and in every social structure. But there are ways to keep that stone not dropping to the ground, to keep it floating up in the air. And we have used politics and a religion and things like that. But new inventions can make us reminded of trying to create an equal society.
So this movie, The Square, takes place by and large in a museum.
Mm-hmm.
And the lead character is a museum director.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a very fancy guy. He seems pretty pleased with himself. He's good looking and he's got a good fancy job. He has a Tesla. He seems to have it all. And he's the one who is implementing this artwork, the square.
Exactly. He's the chief curator, as you said, and he's deciding that this exhibition should come to the museum. And he thinks the values are great of this idea, of course.
Right. But then something happens to him. He's robbed.
He gets robbed on his cell phone and his wallet. And he can track the cell phone, you know, on Find My iPhone or an app like that. But he doesn't know where the robbers live exactly, but he knows in which building, but not which
flat. It's a big apartment
flat.
Building, exactly. But he doesn't know which one.
Yeah, exactly. But he decides to do something that in the moment maybe seemed like the right thing, but when you think about it in retrospective, it was not a very good idea. He writes a note where it says, I know that you who live in this apartment have stolen my cell phone and my wallet. Return it within 24 hours or we will come back. And then he prints, 150 copies of this and goes out to that building, takes the elevator to the top and puts one note in every single apartment. So he's accusing everybody in that house for being thieves in order to get his cell phone back.
Right. Yeah. So then there's an unintended consequence that goes on to really affect him. Mm. So he's doing this sort of on the side where he's trying to deal with his personal life kind of unraveling after this incident, but then keep up appearances on the other side professionally.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way of describing the film. The film takes place in a museum and him being a boss over this museum or the creative curator. And he's a person that likes these humanistic topics, these ideas. But I put up dilemmas for him. I put up him in situations where it's hard to be a humanist, when it's hard to be morally correct, in order to highlight, you know, that so much of the situation that we end up in is what controls our behavior.
I'm just wondering about what you're saying about upper middle class Swedish society, or all of upper middle class society, because this could easily have taken place in a Los Angeles museum as it could anywhere else.
I mean, since me myself is upper middle class, I think it's interesting to look at myself in a self-critical way, you know, not only doing portraits of the hero examples, but also trying to dare to look on when we fail. And I wanted that the main character, he had a possibility to do the right thing at a certain point, but then you missed out on that possibility and you have to live with that guilt.
I mean, do you think that he will live with the guilt or excuse it away? Because there's a scene where he calls up to apologize to this person he has wronged.
Mm.
And he starts off on the phone, leaving a voice message, apologizing. And by the end of it, he's gotten to the point where he has excused himself because all of these problems are actually societally created, these inequalities.
Mm. But isn't that interesting? I agree on Christian in some ways that, you know, some problems we only can solve on a society level. But some problems, of course, we can solve on a personal, individual level. And when we are talking about society, for example, if we see a beggar on the street, is it even possible to solve that on an individual level? I mean, in Sweden, you know, where we have a quite big trust in the state and the idea about like taxes and things like that, when the beggars came to the streets in Sweden, first of all, we were like shocked because we were not used to see this. It came Romanian beggars because there were some laws in the European Union that made them possible for them to travel to Sweden. And we were like, where is the state? Well, does the state doesn't take care of them? But very quickly, we put down this question to an individual level. So it was like up to you to give. Either you're a good person or you're a bad person. But at the same time, I feel powerless when I see a beggar. How can I change this human being's life fundamentally, I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just giving for the moment. And I don't think that we should trick ourselves and take some of these big society questions and put them down to an individual level, because then we will never solve them. But Christian's guilt that he's dealing with is definitely on a personal level. He should handle that on an individual level, directly, himself. But his guilt makes him like to blame it on all other different kind of situations. And so that's his way of dealing with guilt.
The square, the physical square, that is the art project in your movie. It's very small.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the inspiration came out of, you know, a pedestrian crossing. You know, with a couple of lines in the street, we have created a very strong social contract that cars should be careful with pedestrians. I mean, a pedestrian crossing is a beautiful human invention. Yeah. That we actually agree on this and we respect these couple of lines in the streets only. And our idea was like we should like create this 4x4 meter big square. And within that square, we should create a new social contract. So once again, it's like a traffic sign that just should remind us about these values. So, but of course, the best thing if we didn't need a square at all to remind us about these values. The best thing was if like they existed, this social contract existed everywhere. But the feeling is it doesn't. These social contracts don't exist in the way that I wanted them to exist.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ruben Östlund, he is the director of the new movie, The Square. All right, let's round out the week with Christian Bordahl and
yes,
some
hi
listener
there.
Feedback. Hi.
Absolutely. You talked earlier with Tom Steyer, who spent $10 million of his own money with a national ad campaign to convince Congress to impeach Donald Trump. Mike McGill says, I'm no fan of Trump's by any means, but that said, Democrats would first have to settle on an impeachable offense they can clearly prove with evidence, and then need to get a large number of Republican senators to vote in favor, and then they'd have to deal with President Mike Pence. Craig Loudon said, impeachment? Then what? Did you ever think about what comes next? And Daniel Erskine says, the high crimes and misdemeanors standard has not and will not be reached. It actually looks like the investigation is heading in the direction of Clinton, the DNC, and Mueller himself. Ryan Love, however, says, everyone with any integrity should be demanding impeachment. Mattia Nuzzo agrees. He says, yes, what's happening in the White House is not normal. We must continue to fight the messaging war. Tim Donovan pulls no punches. He says, put the scumbag on a rocket ship with all his scum spawn and send him into the sun.
Oh.
Joseph Bennett
There's
says,
a lot of alliteration
sick of him.
There,
impeach. Yes. So, as always, people on both sides of this, but some thoughtful conversation
and
there.
Compassioned as well. All yeah. right. Well, thank you. Have a good Halloween
and
weekend.
And you.
Thank you. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.